So, do you want to get that? I asked. Oh, all right. Sorry, she squeaked and she lunged for the phone. Hey, my friends, how the heck are you? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Really, truly, very happy you've tuned in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Shelley Eisenhaupten brings us our first story, and it's called Cour Nan. I don't believe in omens, signs, or portents. As a literary agent, I go off a feel, off vibes. And let me tell you, this girl was a basket full of just-washed, fluff-dried puppies. 22, maybe 23. Hair a little ash-blonde bob with faint freckles stippling the bridge of her tiny Rockwellian nose. She reminded me of a happier Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon, even down to the cute rasp in her voice. As a personal assistant, she was everything I was looking for. Indeed, even her name, Kit Perkin, seemed almost too good to be true. Beneath a mauve vest, she wore a tight white t-shirt I recognized from Clotilde's that cost $200. She was conspicuously fit. That worked for me. When media articles invariably describe me as high energy, I never demurred. "You must work out," I said, pointing to a light cambray veins visible on her biceps and forearms. Yeah, I like to cross-train," she said, as if she were sitting on Santa's lap. "I used to swim in high school. I sort of transitioned into triathlons after I joined a running club in college." That's wonderful," I said, thinking this might turn into an added bonus, a personal trainer qua personal assistant. "Well, I've reached an intermediate level of cycling myself. Maybe we could go out for a quick 50-miler upstate sometime." "Cour Nan!" "I beg your pardon?" She pointed to my alumna chair in the far corner by the Broadway window. "You went to Lafayette, right? Isn't that their motto? Why not?" "It's remarkable you know that." "It was actually in the top tier of my college list, but I got a scholarship somewhere else and my dad encouraged me to take it." "And where was that again?" "Purdue." "Okay. Smart enough, but not too smart. Not like those Ivy League jerks constantly forcing Harvard and Princeton references into discussions about hand sanitizers or muffalettas. I didn't bother to mask my surprise. "Well, my first love was chemistry," she said. She actually blushed. "Unorthodox choice for a budding literary agent," I said. "Well, I ended up transferring to Rutgers, though to be closer to my dad after he got sick." "Oh, I'm sorry." Her mouth twitched quickly, and she chewed the inside of her lip for a second. "Yeah, he didn't really take care of himself. He's been overweight pretty much forever. He was dealing with some stuff and just kind of went downhill." She even managed to make her own sigh sound preppy. "Yeah, that's why I'm such a health freak now. Anyway, my passion for fiction kind of overcame the chemistry thing." "So you're a secret writer at heart?" "No way," her little nose crinkled when she giggled. "I could never be a writer. I'm a reader. That's why I did the Columbia Publishing course." She brushed a blonde strand of hair from her face and smiled. She was too adorable. "Well, I guess that begs the question. What's your favorite book?" She inched forward to the edge of her chair. Her excitement was infectious. "Oh my gosh, I'd have to say The Count of Monte Cristo. Every year I get up at 5 a.m. on New Year's and read it straight through." "How charming," I said. And I meant it. She was so fresh, so candid, so lightweight. She clearly lacked the sharp elbows that helped another bright young woman slash her way up from an intern's cubicle past the pawings and pantings of Jerome and Lawrence Mir, ultimately to push the degenerate principals of Two Mir Media off the ledge of their very agency they founded. Fortunately, I didn't need another ambitious me. I needed someone to get coffee, to screen my calls, and most importantly, to bulldoze the slush pile of 600 queries a week into literary landfill. And to do it cheaply. Well, I was supposed to see somebody for a follow-up interview tomorrow. But what the heck, I extended my hand. The job's yours. Cournon, right? Really? Oh my gosh, thank you so much, she said while pumping my hand. The phone on the desk bleated its robotic trill as she continued pumping my arm up and down like a thirsty convict on the run, desperate for water to burst from my other palm. The phone rang again, and I lifted an eyebrow. So, do you want to get that? I asked. Oh, right, sorry, she squeaked. She lunged for the phone and shook her freckled platinum orb of a head before settling the handset to her ear. Ms. Eichenhausten's office? She glanced across the desk at me. Will you hold a moment, please? She pressed the hold button and looked up. Something about a Mondrian? It was my decorator. Mid-century modern was over, again, and now that I was on top of the heap, I needed to make a statement in the office. I'd initially mused about an earth-tone cascade of sages, russets, and emeralds, but then at a party in Bridgehampton, I saw the den of that jerk from CNN. Besides, this was Manhattan, not Manaus. Who needed to be bludgeoned to death by nature? Lionel was only too happy to pivot to rectangles in primary colors. I gotta take this, I said. How about a smoothie? Oh, no thank you, Kit said, beaming. I just had one. As in, would you get me a smoothie? I clarified. Oh, sorry, of course. What kind? Surprise me. I punched the line with a throbbing hold light. Lionel! When I arrived the next morning, Kit sat behind her desk outside my office with two tall cups next to her laptop. She handed me one with a sleeved paper straw as I approached. Good morning, she chirped. Smoothie? This kid was nothing if not on the ball. Oh, thanks so much, I said, nibbling the straw from its paper wrapper. I started sipping the smoothie absently when the taste took me aback. Then I noticed these weren't cheap disposable cups, but the expensive insulated ones we hand out in swag bags to our authors. Hey, this is fabulous, I said. There were hints of vanilla and wisps of cinnamon and nutmeg somewhere in this fantastic froth. Where did you get this? Not at the place downstairs. Nah, I made 'em. She caught the surprise on my face and leaned toward me. Personally, she said, lowering her voice, I think those guys downstairs worry too much about their margins. They use ice and a lot of juice, but look at what you lose. If you're serious about getting in cycling shape, you can't get too much protein. That's why I load up on Greek yogurt. None of the fat, all of the protein. Hold on. You made this? Cournon! I set my briefcase on her desk and walked down the hall and around the corner to the office kitchen. There on the counter was a heavy-duty 3-horsepower commercial blender with a thick black base and a 64-ounce carafe. I'd never seen one online for less than $300. Where did this come from? You didn't get an agency Amex yet, did you? No, I bought it. It's the same model I have at home. It kicks some serious smoothie butt. Now that she was standing, I noticed she wore a beautiful mauve linen jacket over another dazzling white t-shirt with a subdued bathrobe-like waffle texture. "Well, I don't expect you to be buying stuff for the office." "Well, it beats getting mugged for $10 a pop downstairs. As many smoothies as I drink, it pays for itself." "Well, I gotta tell you, it's the best I've ever had. Unfortunately," I said with a sigh, "I'm afraid the job's not all smoothies, Facebook, and Fortnite. I need you to get started on the slush pile." Kit beamed like she was trying to start a fire with her smile. "Great!" Not the usual reaction for a wannabe literary agent tasked with reading 30 to 40,000 email queries a year. "You can't fall in love with everything," I began. "You gotta look ahead. Who's gonna buy this? Sure, there are cycles, but at bottom, we tell people what they want to read. Think of us as the Praetorian Guard, the Iron Hymen, so to speak." She squinted and nodded slowly. "Hack through the queries," I continued, no pun intended. I hadn't even caught the pun until she cocked her head like a corgi. "You're going to get thousands. Can't read them all. It was different back in the days of hard copies. Well, I was told it was. I'm not that old." "Still, it makes sense. Back then, it took effort and expense to send out a manuscript. Now sending 100 queries is like sending 5. "So you don't even respond?" "Look, there's just not time. If vampires are in, you're going to get 1 million pitches for vampire stories. Or zombies, or golfers with supernatural caddies that teach them life is in the details. Or some such nonsense. Just ghost them. Isn't that what the kids call it now?" Her pixie smile melted. Her eyes, far from looking like shimmering aquamarines of a moment before, now wilted at the corners as if she'd been cut from the cheerleading squad. I figured I'd buck her up with a story that always killed. "Look, years ago, at a writers' conference, I was on a panel, and they were talking about why writers write. Every time you read or hear this, it's always, 'If I didn't write, I'd die.'" I sipped my smoothie and leaned against the refrigerator. "There was this one guy, Thomas More Soames, used to write science fiction stuff, fantasy realms, and he was indefatigable. 2 or 3 times a year, he'd pitch these things, and they were huge. I'm talking 300,000 and 400,000 word. Massive, dystopian doorstops. Just impossibly prodigious output. For years, and stories. Collections of short stories. He must have churned out hundreds a year, and this on top of these engine block novels. His queries were so earnest. But they just kept coming. Nobody ever read past the byline. To my knowledge, he never sold anything. He was notorious among every agent in the country as the king of the slush pile. So it's, 'If I didn't write, I'd die,' and my turn up on the panel comes up, and the audience is roaring with the parable of the king of the slush pile. 'Sometimes,' I said, 'the universe is sending you a message. Just go ahead and die already.'" Kit's eyes narrowed, and she nodded again. She got it. "Yeah, I heard that story." "You did? I never told you that. Well, it was legendary at the Columbia Publishing course. Oh, it's on the internet, too." "Yeah, well," I said, pushing myself upright off the refrigerator. "You need a thick skin in the literary game." Before the end of the first week, Kit was bringing me 2 smoothies a day, 3, if I didn't have a lunch meeting. I'm sure it was only the power of suggestion, but I could almost feel the extra protein in my brief workouts at the gym. As I sipped the foam from a kiterific morning smoothie, I got the email I'd been hoping for. A save the date for Sun Valley. While I didn't flatter myself that I was anything but the lowliest tadpole in the water, Still, outside that formidable pond, I was a visible, powerful woman, on the rise in the media industry, and even billionaires and their suck-ups were always looking to peddle a memoir. "Kit!" I hollered, spraying flecks of smoothie on my laptop screen. She popped into the office with a legal pad. She wore a tailored mauve suit with broad notched lapels and a Klieg Light white silk blouse with a high collar. "What's up, Chief?" "A, that's a stunning suit." She curtsied, or more properly, kitsied, and batted her impossibly perfect lashes. "Why, thank you." "B, it's not escaped my gimlet eye that you wear a great deal of mauve." She grinned and softly pressed her lapels. "My favorite color." "C, I've gotten to save the date for Sun Valley this summer. I'm going to need you to clear my schedule for that week and arrange a private jet, or, better still, glom me a seat on someone else's." Kit nibbled her lip into that precious little twist as she hurriedly scratched out instructions. She looked up. "So, are you going to do the ride?" "The ride?" "After the Sun Valley Conference, a bunch of new media guys from California and some hangers-on do a bike ride to Jackson Hole. They call themselves the Hardcores, C-O-R-P-S. Kind of nerdy, but still. I'm pretty sure Bill Walton joined them one year." I'd never heard of Bill Walton, but if some lamprey from Disney could do it, so could I. "Eh, sounds like fun," I said. Kit tucked her legal pad under the sleeve of her mauve suit. The contrast between the two colors were jarring. She whipped out her iPhone and played it with her thumbs like a kalimba. "Says here it's 285 miles. They do it over 3 days, like a 13,000-foot climb altogether. Nice." "Yeah. If I was going to climb 13,000 feet over close to 300 miles, I was going to have to need a whole lot more protein smoothies." On Monday, I walked into my office to see a shiny new bike trainer stand set up parallel to my Broadway window. "What in the world?" Kit popped her sweet little gooseberry head around the door jamb. "Oh, hey, I went for a ride this weekend with some friends." She stepped over the threshold of my office, her tanned arms a flawless cocoa brown pouring from beneath a sleeveless mauve top. Those faint little freckles across her nose had bulked up, and her pretty round face now brought to mind a deliciously toasted English muffin. "Yeah, we drove up to the Adirondacks Friday night and spent the weekend riding all over the mountains. So amazing. There's really nothing like that mountain roads for giving you that pump, you know?" "But what does that have to do with..." "Hang on. So one of the guys in this group I ride with actually owns a bike shop. I was telling him about you, and he asked if you had a training stand in your office. Anyway, long story short, I got it at cost. Don't worry. But, hey, if you want to get serious, you can't just ride a couple of weekends a month in the summer. Look how much time you spend in the office. Are you telling me there aren't some calls you couldn't make while you were riding? You could easily pick up another 100 miles a week just scrolling through emails." Again, I didn't bother to mask my surprise. "Oh, and one more thing." She popped out of my office and returned holding the vanilla cinnamon nutmeg elixir vitae in an agency cup and placed efficiently on my desk. "Anyway," she continued, "if you're really looking to train for this Sun Valley deal, hey, there's a place down in Virginia that gives you a great mix of altitude and climbing. It's a couple of hours outside D.C. You've been there?" "Oh, yeah," said Kit. "A group of us trained down there for an Ironman. Highland County, one of the highest average elevations of any county east of the Mississippi. Easier and cheaper than flying back and forth to Denver." I sipped the first of what was likely to be 4 smoothies for the day. "Interesting. Let me think about it." I was on my bike with a towel around my neck, wearing a sports bra and shorts. Well, I had all the blinds pulled down on all the windows. I didn't want to get too sweaty in the office, but Kit was right. Just building up the miles, even at a lolling pace, was already paying dividends with my endurance. I was shuttling through articles on my iPad when I saw that a tetralogy of futuristic dystopian novels by Thomas More Soames had not only been purchased by Bertelsmann in a $7 million preempt, but HBO had acquired the rights, with Peter Jackson signed to executive producer a multi-year series around the story. "Kit!" I yelled through the closed door. She popped into the office with her legal pad. She wore an off-the-shoulder mauve bandage dress. On her chest dangled an amethyst pendant the size of a spark plug. "Hey, smoothie boss. Did you see this story about HBO buying the rights to Thomas Soames' series?" Her brow furrowed a bit under the bangs of her little blonde bob as she chewed her lip that, I noticed, never needed lipstick. "You're king of the slush pile guy? You said no one ever bought his work." "Listen, it was dreck, but this business is all about timing. Look through any archived emails in case something slipped through the cracks. To have made that sale, he must have had an agent, although I can't imagine who." Never mind. If we track him down, we can always Velcro the business. In any event, go back through the last 12 months of queries and see what other nutjobs might have pitched lunatic SF stuff. You know how this works. We have a tight window to capitalize on this before the next fad. A chance to meet with event organizers from the National Book Festival opened up. The agency had several clients who would be participating and dozens more whose sales could benefit from some intense schmoozing. The festival wasn't until August, but if I could iron out some wrinkles ahead of time, well, that was my job. I roared for Kit, as if reading my mind, she entered carrying a second morning smoothie. "I scored a few meetings later this week down in D.C., I said. "I've been thinking about your Virginia idea. If you're free this weekend, maybe you could drive the bikes down and meet me." "Oh, seriously? Oh, that would be great." "You can take my car and pick me up after Friday." Oh, crap. I had a dentist appointment Friday morning. I'd have to come back Thursday evening. "Hey, what's the matter?" Friday morning conflict. Pain in the butt dentist. I've already rescheduled once. "You sure? Sun Valley's less than a month away. When are you going to have time to get any work at altitude?" "Then again," I mused aloud, "it's only going to be a cleaning, not like I need any real work or anything." Kit cleared her throat. "I don't want to tell you your business, and you really don't want to embarrass yourself out there with those guys. Not sure if you've ever ridden out west, but it's grueling." I weighed the demerits. The pained huff of a dental receptionist was nothing pitted against the ignominy of quitting a ride with a pack of faux alpha douchebags. "Yeah, your point's well taken. I mean, if you look like you're in good shape," Kit said with a shrug, "and it's not like they're going to leave you to die out there. It's just that..." She paused to grimace. "For a dentist?" "Nope, you're right. I'd courier over with my apologies to Michael Rosenstein, DDS, an arc of the new thriller Tom Hanks just optioned. If one of those Silicon Valley jerks sees me cry, I'll never live it down. Screw it. I'm in. Cure none." I certainly didn't need a Range Rover in Manhattan. No one does. And yet, when you have to schlep a couple of bikes 800 miles round trip, it's a happy convenience. Rather than stay in some interstate comfort inn, I figured we'd net more and better quality sleep with another night at the Hay Adams, then beat it out of there at 6 a.m. That would still give us plenty of riding time Saturday and a nice morning ride on Sunday. Plus, I had my perky little Perkin. 20 years my junior to grind out the Sunday afternoon slog back to New York on I-81. Rolling out of D.C. just after dawn, I had Kit drive, thus allowing me to read and send emails while she rattled on about an Ironman race in Hawaii, ballooning in Temecula, California, the punitive cost of checking luggage on airline flights, puzzles and wordplay in Tom Wolfe's, to her mind, vastly underrated Bonfire of the Vanities, the horrors of puppy mills, and handicapping the odds of eventual statehood for Puerto Rico. It was warm and sunny when we pulled into the parking lot of the Family Dollar in Churchville, Virginia. The chirping of the birds in the nearby trees sounded hopelessly enchanting. Crows cawed and intermittent shadows passed slowly over the ground. When Kit pulled the bikes from inside the rear of the car, naturally hers was mauve, as was her outfit, mauve top, mauve bike shorts, and mauve socks peeping from beneath mercifully black bike shoes. We blazed through the flat part of western Augusta County and beneath the canopy shading U.S. 250 through the George Washington National Forest. The first mountain tortured me with the brutal climb. It seemed like 50 switchbacks and yet straight up. By the time we reached the old Confederate breastworks at the summit, I was sure my quads would explode. We'd just crossed into Highland County, and now it was supposed to get high? I thought ahead to Sun Valley and some AI maven cackling at me as I pulled off the road to throw up. I pressed on and coasted down the first mountain. Kit looked back every once in a while to beam encouragement from her sugar-white smile. How could my sweet little Perkin be such a sadist? We turned around just shy of the West Virginia line. I had no idea where we were, but I knew we'd have to pedal again over all those mountains just to get back to the car. Not only was I ready to ride off tomorrow altogether, today's ride gave me plenty of time to gin up excuses for not accompanying the boys to Jackson Hole. Foremost among them, that I'd not even been invited to join. I decided to yell up to Kit that I was done when she disappeared over the crest of yet another mountain. I reached the top and saw her stopped a couple of hundred yards below on the shoulder. I was beginning rolling downhill, within seconds coasting my way too fast for my comfort. I was breathing so hard I couldn't hear anything but roaring wind, whirring tires, and my pounding heart. Kit pointed up behind me. I turned my head and a black pickup truck blew by me, missing me by inches. I wobbled and my front tire slipped from under me. I fell skidding and tumbling across the far lane, then down the side of the mountain, the wire extending from my brake calipers clipping me on the cheek in a final insult. The bike hung up on a branch of a fallen log, and I slid to the base of a locust tree, 40 feet below the road. I don't know if I lost consciousness. I don't think so. But I was definitely rocked. My ankle hurt. Well, everything hurt, but I could move my feet and hands, so I knew I wasn't paralyzed. I looked up and saw Kit carefully resting her bike against a tree. Gingerly, she made her way down to me where I leaned against the locust tree like a heap of dirty rags. "Well, that was impressive," she said, grinning as she removed her mauve helmet. "Wow!" Neither the brilliant smile, nor the mauve helmet, nor even the cute little Tatum-esque bob seemed so endearing at the moment. My ankle throbbed, but I didn't see any bones sticking out of it. A tremendous road burn covered both legs and both arms from where I'd skidded and tumbled. I unbuckled my helmet. Blood seeped profusely from my face where the brake wire had punctured my cheek. I guess we need to call an ambulance, I said. Kit shook her head. Oh, no, there's no cell service out here. This is not good, Kit. She knelt down and tilted my chin. She frowned and wiped my cheek. I saw blood smeared all over her fingertips, and I could feel more still pulsing out of the wound. "Well, yeah, that's the thing about cuts to the head," she said, rubbing her fingers in the dirt, pumicing them with loam of the forest floor. "You bleed like a stuck pig." Was I losing my mind? What did she just say? What? She stared down at my road burn, and I looked down as well. Instead of pink scratches and strawberries beginning to scab, blood flowed from the abrasions. Kit chewed her lip in a way I'd always thought so cute. "Well, I guess you do really need to have a thick skin in the literary game." What's the matter with you? You've got to go get help." Blood soaked my shirts, and that was just from my face. Every scratch and gouge on my body now leaked like a cardboard canoe. "Oh, from the look of things, I won't be waiting long. Don't worry." "From the look of things? Why are you waiting at all? I need medical attention, Kit." I took my helmet all the way off. A cool breeze tickled my face where the blood plopped off my jawline and onto my chest. Kit rocked backwards and sat on the ground, leaning against a tree. Salty sweat rolled into my eyes, blurring my vision. "Did you know that Thomas More Soames was a pseudonym?" she asked. What? "Stay with me, Shelley. This won't be a long story." She tilted her head, captivated by the metronomic dripping from my thigh. "Can't be. Kit, please." A truck downshifted dozens of feet overhead, the first vehicle to pass since I fell. On this lightly traveled mountain road, how many more would there be before evening, before I blacked out? "Well, now, while it's true I heard the story at Columbia," she said, looking up from my bloody knee, "that's not where I first learned of it." She stretched her legs and crossed her ankles at her little mauve socks. "The king of the slush pile? Well, he was actually in the audience at that conference when you humiliated him. No one knew it was him, of course, but I said Soames was a pseudonym. But it broke his heart all the same." Was this another of her rambles like the Puerto Rican statehood monologue? I don't understand. Please. I caught the little eye roll when I said I went to Purdue, and again when I mentioned my love of Dumas. "But you forgot Nabokov's dictum, fondle details." I was lightheaded, maybe dizzy. I'm not sure I even knew the difference. "See, if you'd paid attention, you'd have realized that my first love, chemistry, is kind of the family business. An ancestor of mine was a renowned chemist in England. Given your sense of style, you can appreciate why I love mauve so much. It was Sir William Henry Perkin who literally invented the color mauve. Up till then, understand, purple dye had been hideously expensive to make." "Kit. Oh, you're right. I digress." She set her helmet on the ground next to her and leaned on it with her elbow. "You know what else Sir William did?" I shook my head slowly. I wouldn't die of blood loss, but of boredom. "He was the first to synthesize coumarin. In Europe, they used it as a flavoring. To kill rats as well. They also used it in blood thinners." Had she always rambled like this? If I ever got to the hospital, she was going to have to look for a new job. These interminable stories. "I had told you my father struggled with his weight. He was a pretty sedentary guy, a chemist by training. His real love was fiction. He'd stay up all night writing. You've never seen anything like his dedication. He never slept, no exercise, just him in his chair, fueled only by junk food and his love of writing stories." Well, clinically, yeah, he was morbidly obese. He gets blood thinners prescribed and he starts taking them. But then he goes to his writer's conference and he sees he's wasted his life writing massive dystopian doorstops. He's all alone, no wife, no prospects, and his only child starting college. He's just a punchline, the fat, lonely king of the slush pile, and a hard drive with millions of words no one would ever read. Oh my God. Well, she continued, almost never. He's non compos mentis now, but I managed to get his work in front of Bertelsmann editor I met through the Columbia program. Lacking your exquisite taste, he didn't seem to think my daddy should just go ahead and die already. Kit, I didn't know. So when my dad had his first stroke on top of his heart attack, she interrupted, his prescribed blood thinners automatically refilled. They kept coming in the mail. Eventually, we got to a point where I couldn't take care of him. It killed me to see this warm, funny man so broken and discarded. He has to move into an assisted living place. Once you're a stroke victim, it's not so much assisted living as flat-out nursing home, and yet the blood thinners kept coming to the house. Seeing him in such bad shape, I started working out constantly. Obsessed, you might say. I also studied your agency's blog, Twitter posts from your BS Save the Sloths bike ride in the Hamptons, Lafayette's college motto. The smoothies? I sighed. Look at you, Lafayette himself would be proud. Cournon, indeed. Yeah. You've been slurping down blood thinners like Popeye ate spinach. The once enchanting little rasp in her voice had lost every bit of its former charm. Even tooling around Montauk, she said, you're going to pick up scratches and bumps riding, but out here I didn't even need to cause your wipeout. And what a wipeout it was! You appreciate, of course, the beauty of tumbling down that slope means you're also collecting bruises. You don't just bleed out. You bleed in, too. Throw in an elevated pulse, no cell service, the plasma of a young Romanov, and to paraphrase your dear Marquis, voila! I could feel those bruises now. She was right. This would not end well. Oh, true, I was nervous then when I thought you might bail for your dentist appointment. First bicuspid they scraped, and they'd have panicked and packed you off to Mount Sinai. Fortunately, I could count on your ludicrously unwarranted surfeit of amour propre to carry the day. She glanced up at the treetops and chuckled as she shook her head. Sun Valley, like heck. Okay, so she was going to win. She wasn't going to go for help, and I was going to pass out in a minute, but I wanted to give her something to think about. You'll never get away with it. They'll do an autopsy. I was panting now, struggling to get the words out. They'll wonder why a fit woman of 42 had 6 pounds of blood thinners in her. It'll all come back to you. Kit smiled. I can see you've not spent a lot of time in nature. Those birds you were staring at while I unloaded the car by myself? Yeah, sometimes they wait until you're actually dead before they start pecking and tearing away all the soft tissue. Sometimes. Not always. In any event, the crows and the vultures and the rest of our little woodland friends we'll have you picked clean by the time anybody ever finds you in Virginia's least populated county. Any DNA will be hopelessly degraded, and with the obvious cross-contamination of rat poison and all? I had no strength to respond. Through my tears, I will, of course, beg for a search party. You kept falling back, but you assured me you were okay. You insisted I should just meet you back at the car. I waited until nearly dark, but you never showed. Even if there had been cell service, you left your phone in the car. The sheriff won't be able to start a proper search until tomorrow. But you're talking about miles and miles of woods. Who's to guess where you might have left the road? What if, she said, her eyebrows arching, you were abducted? Kit rose from the leafy ground and dusted off her bottom. It's like you said, boss. Timing is everything in this business. Very good. All right, I've switched over to the Alfred Hitchcock Best of Mystery book. This one's written by Edward D. Hoke, and it's called Warrior's Farewell. Some early morning fishermen had found the body washed up on the sandy beach like a great dead whale cast aside by nature, and it was only a few hours until the authorities identified the man as Sam Zodiac, an unmarried used car dealer and petty gambler. I read the item in the afternoon editions of the paper with great interest because at one time Sam Zodiac had probably been my best friend. He was a large man in every way, and when I first knew him, he was an army sergeant, looking very much the part. That was something like 15 years ago in a place called Korea that most of the kids don't even remember today. I was young and sort of frightened in those days, frightened of a place I didn't know and people I didn't understand. Prowling the streets of Seoul at night, lonely and far from home, I was thankful for the company of a man like Sergeant Zodiac. Unlike the others, he wasn't particularly interested in picking up any of the girls who cluttered the bars of the city, and he managed to stay reasonably sober during the hours we'd spend together. "You know, Corporal," he'd say over a beer at a crowded table in one of those smoky places, "I just look forward to doing my job every day. Sometimes I think the two most important words in the language are war and justice. And they're not a great deal different from each other if you're fighting a just war like this one. They're invaders, and they gotta be killed. It's as simple as that." "You talking like a career soldier, Sarge," I like to kid him about it. "I'll stay in as long as they need me, that's for sure." He took the cigar out of his mouth. "Justice, that's what we've got to deliver." "Now what about when you get home?" I sip my beer. "A lot of fellows talk about going back to school. Ugh, shoot, I'm too old for that. I'm over 30 already. Now I'm going to get me a little lot and sell used cars. That's where the money is. Then maybe I'll take off an afternoon a week and go out to the racetrack or something. I like to see them ponies run." "They say it might be a long war, Sarge." He puffed on the cigar for a minute. "Well, then I'll stay for a long time. First things first, we gotta end this thing." 2 weeks later, we went into battle, one of the last big engagements before the truce was signed, and I saw for myself exactly what he meant. It was a bloody scrap, not far from the 38th parallel, in an area of hilly farmland that had changed hands at least twice before. The plains had softened up the area, leaving only the old stone farmhouse standing roofless in the sun. We came over that hill with our rifles ready, backed up by a BAR and mortar team, and immediately exchanged fire with a retreating enemy squad. It was the better part of an hour before we'd taken the farmhouse and decided we could hold it till morning. After an hour or so of scouting the area, we flushed out a Korean farmer who'd been hiding in a ditch. He didn't look quite right, but then none of them ever did to our eyes. He seemed friendly enough at first, and pretty soon the PFC who was guarding him put down his carbine to light a cigarette. It was his first and last mistake. The farmer made a dive for the rifle and got off two quick shots before I ran up and clubbed him to the ground with my own weapon. The PFC, well, he was dead. "He's a North Korean officer," I said, ripping away the farm clothes to reveal the last vestiges of a uniform beneath. "I guess we came on too fast for him to get away." "Damn spy," Sergeant Zodiac muttered. He was the ranking non-com, and he had to decide what to do with the man. "Too bad you didn't kill him." The man was bleeding from the temple, but otherwise seemed to be suffering no ill effects from my blows. "It was faster to slug him, Sarge. I didn't want him spraying bullets around the place. Shall we send him back with somebody?" "With the kid dead, we can't spare a man." "We leave him tied up in the farmhouse, then. They'll find him tomorrow." Sergeant Zodiac shook his head. "And let him kill somebody else, maybe? Nope, there's only one way to handle this." He reached out and took the carbine from me. "He's a prisoner of war, Sarge." "Like hell he is. He's out of uniform. He's nothing but a spy and a murderer. And as such, he can be executed."
"Without a trial?"
But Sergeant Zodiac half turned toward the prisoner and fired a quick burst from the carbine, ending the discussion. The man's head jerked back in the shock of death, and he went down hard in the tall grass of the field. We left him there with the other bodies, and nobody ever mentioned it again. Sergeant Zodiac surprised me and everyone else when he didn't re-enlist for another tour of duty. He returned to the States with me, and we were discharged together in San Francisco. I moved out east after that, spending a couple of years finishing my education at a little college in Ohio. But all the time, I kept in touch with Zodiac, and an odd sort of friendship seemed to grow between us. I saw him once after college on a trip out west, and we went on a two-day drunk that was unlike any of our subdued army outings. Sam had his used car lot and was making pretty good living at it. Drinking together on that visit, I think we both realized for the first time the bond of friendship that existed between us. 6 months later, when I married a girl I'd met in college, Sam Zodiac came east to be my best man. After that, I didn't hear from him for something like a year until he phoned me one evening and told me that he was getting married. "Hey, that's great news, Sam," I told him, meaning it. "I was beginning to think you'd never do it." "I just want you out here for it," he said. "Best man, the whole deal. Just let me know the date, and I'll be there." Sam had left San Francisco and was living in a smaller ocean community in a neighboring state. I flew out there on my vacation, although the wedding was still a month away. I was anxious to meet the girl Sam Zodiac had finally chosen. Never did meet Anne. On the very night I was flying out, an ex-mental patient who lived in the next block from her went wild and shot his wife. Then he went out on the front porch with a gun, saw Anne running across the street toward the house, and shot her dead. He wounded two others before the police managed to subdue him, and I arrived at the airport to find that tragedy had struck Sam Zodiac. "I don't know what to do," he told me the next day. "I'm just lost and going around in circles. Anne was a nurse, always helping people. We were just getting out of the car when she heard the shots and went running. Crazy. I should have grabbed her. I should have held her back. I should have done 100 things. "Hey, it wasn't your fault." "The hell of it is. This fellow, Gordon, will get off free. There's not even a death penalty in this state anymore." "Well, they'll put him away for a long time." "Yeah, a few years in a mental hospital, and he'll be walking the streets a free man. I know." I stayed for a week, trying to calm him, and I thought I'd succeeded pretty well. His prediction proved to be correct, though, and George Gordon was never brought to trial for killing Anne. The others recovered from their wounds, including his wife, and Gordon was sent to the state hospital for treatment. I went back east to my own wife, and though the correspondence with Sam Zodiac continued, we saw no more of each other for 3 years. Then one day I received a brief letter from him, enclosing a newspaper clipping. It told how a man named George Gordon, recently released from a mental hospital, had been shot and killed during an apparent robbery. Sam's only comment on the clipping was a single sentence in his letter, "This is what I call justice, not revenge." Shortly after that, I changed jobs and became a purchasing expediter for a large chemical firm. One of my duties was a monthly trip to a supplier in Sam's city. Suddenly, we were seeing each other again on a regular basis. One night, over beers, I asked him how he was doing. "Darn good. The used car business is a little off, but I'm making it up at the track. Even own part interest in a racehorse now." "That's great, Sam." I found myself trying to read the backward lettering on the neon sign in the bar's front window. "There's something I've been wanting to ask you," I said finally. "Fire away, boy. That clipping you sent me a few months back about the fellow who killed Ann?" "Yeah, I could read nothing into his expression." "Well, Sam, how should I say it?" "I'll say it for you," he told me quietly. "It's no mystery, really. The things in the Bible, an eye for an eye and all that stuff, there's not even a death penalty in this state anymore." I know. Suddenly my blood had turned cold. "I know what you're thinking. You're remembering that time in Korea." "No. I was right then. I'm right now. He killed Ann and nobody punished him for it. What was I supposed to do?" I couldn't answer that. I didn't want to answer it. I just wanted to get away from there as quickly as I could. After that, I started cutting down on my visits with Sam Zodiac. Sometimes I'd sneak into town for a day and not even tell him about it. I saw the signs for his used car place around town, and I knew he must be doing pretty well, but I didn't want to see him anymore. About a year after George Gordon's death, the city where Sam lived was the scene of a particularly brutal sex murder involving a 14-year-old girl. She'd been found in the trunk of an abandoned car, and it took the police only an hour to trace the ownership of the vehicle and send out a 10-state alarm. The suspect was arrested in San Francisco a few days later and brought back to Sam's city under close police guard. The newspapers reported that the man had confessed to the killing. There were maybe 100 people outside police headquarters when the suspect, a young man named Asker, arrived. As he was led into the building between two detectives, a single shot from somewhere across the street hit him in the back of the head, killing him instantly. In the near panic that followed, the killer made a clean getaway. I read the newspaper accounts of the killing with a gnawing sense of urgency. It couldn't be Sam Zodiac again. It just couldn't be. Yet I had to know to be certain. I arranged to fly out there the following weekend. I wired Sam that I was coming, and he met me at the airport smiling and friendly as ever, despite the fact that I'd seen little of him during the past year. "How you been, boy? How's the wife? Any kids yet?" It was the same old Sam, and I instantly regretted the suspicions which had been breeding in my mind. Regretted them until I remember Gordon and the Korean thing. Later, over dinner, I ventured into my object of my trip. "Yeah, I read about the killing of that fellow, Asker, at the police headquarters. Oh, awful thing." "Awful? Asker's crime was awful. His killing wasn't." "He hadn't even stood trial yet." Sam Zodiac waved a hand. "What good would a trial have been? There's no death penalty in this state anymore." "No." I lit a cigarette and tried to keep my hand from shaking. "Then you think his killing was justified?" "Of course." "Just like George Gordon's?" "Just like it." "The people of this state never had a chance to vote on capital punishment. The legislature and the governor just got together and abolished it. You think that's right?" "For some people, it's hard to tell the difference between right and wrong. You killed Asker, didn't you?" He eyed me slyly across the table. "Justice was done. Sam, Sam, what's happening to you? Oh, it's not me. It's the modern morality, or lack of it. He focused on me with wide, intent eyes. People look at me, and what do they see? A used car dealer, a petty gambler. I suppose I'm the sort of guy who's supposed to have no morals at all. And yet, look at the rest of them. Condoning every sort of violence, every excess. The murderer today is to be pitied because of his tragic childhood or low IQ or mental illness or economic blight. They don't execute murderers anymore. They send them to a hospital or to prison for a few years, and then they turn them free to kill again. I had to get out of there, into the fresh air where maybe it wouldn't seem so much of a bad dream. Sam paid the check and left with me, strolling at my side, with one arm around my shoulders like the old army buddy that he was. I'm a warrior in the battle for justice, he said. A warrior. I think you're mad, I told him. How long are you going to keep this up? The sly look was back on his face, not entirely hidden by the night. You're a buddy, so I'm going to tell you something. You'd never prove it to the police anyway, so I'm safe in telling you. There have been 5 of them now, 5 of them since last year. The others were downstate and didn't make such splashy headlines. 5? All criminals, all murderers, who escaped the death penalty because of our laws. We were strolling across the Bay Bridge, with the lights of the harbor obscured by the nightly mists. I turned to him, for a moment speechless from the horror of what he was telling me. Then I said, "You really think you have the right?" Sam Zodiac stared straight ahead at the deserted bridge. I have 3 others on my list already. It was then that I pushed him with all my strength, saw him grasping frantically at the rail before he toppled over with the beginnings of a scream cut short as he hit the murky waters below. They found his body the following morning, while I was still in town, and though I read the account in the afternoon paper with a growing sense of relief, there was one thing that nagged at my mind, one tiny troublesome thing. When I'd realized what I was doing in the last second before his face vanished from sight, Sam Zodiac hadn't looked really angry. Instead, there'd been a sort of a challenge in his expression, as if he were saying to me, "See what I mean?" Well, all right, good and wonderful people, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying thank you so very much for joining me, and I'll ask you to tune in again next time, if you please. Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.